The Golden Age of Radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, Cecil Parker and Sheila Sims star in the BBC drama A Case for Dr. Morrell. We'll also hear a movie preview of the 1936 musical One in a Million, starring Sonia Henie and Don Ameche. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, a movie preview of the 1936 musical One in a Million, starring Sonia Henie and Don Ameche. Right now, Cecil Parker and Sheila Sims star in the BBC drama A Case for Dr. Morrell, with an episode entitled Sleepwalker, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
I hate her. I hate her. Now.
Richard.
Huh? What?
What are you doing?
Where am I? I was dreaming. Walking in my sleep.
Richard.
A horrible dream.
Close your mother's door. We don't want to wake her.
Thank heavens you woke me.
I heard someone moving. I thought your mother might be ill.
It was a horrible dream. Horrible.
Go back to bed.
Yes, Helen. Of course.
Richard!
What is it?
In your hand. A knife. You're holding a knife.
BBC presents A Case for Dr. Morrell, another adventure by Ernest Dudley, with Cecil Parker as the famous Dr. Morrell and Sheila Sim as his secretary, Miss Frail. The Sleepwalker.
Oh, who can that be at this time of night?
One good way to find out, Miss Frail, would be to answer it.
Oh, hello? This is Dr. Morrell's house. Hello? Hello? Well, who is it? Well, there's no one there.
Well, in that case, hang up, and we'll proceed with my work.
Oh, I do wish people wouldn't do that. It makes me feel quite creepy.
Probably a burglar casing the joint.
Doing what, Doctor?
Surely you've heard that underworld expression before. The burglar telephones the house he's selected to discover if it's unoccupied or not. Quite the usual procedure.
I'm sure no burglar would dream of robbing you. They know you too well.
I'm not quite sure whether to feel flattered or not.
Oh, well, you know what I mean. Anyway, I believe you're only trying to scare me.
If I may continue with my dictating.
Yes, Dr. Morrell. Where were we?
Well, I was propounding that every criminal is actuated by a compulsive urge to encompass his own doom. In each human being, the seeds of death are implanted from the moment of birth. And in order to destroy himself, the evildoer deliberately seeks to draw attention to his crime.
I know, I still don't see that.
No, Miss Frey, possibly because your comprehension of the psychology of the criminal is not so profound as mine.
Oh, of course, you know it all.
You are saying...
Nothing, Doctor, nothing.
It is only by this understanding of the criminal psychology and knowledge of the principles that govern psychiatric behavior that the police investigator can hope to operate with any success. Now, take, for instance, that case of sleepwalking, which I made comparatively short work of.
Oh, that odd young man, Richard Wilson, you mean?
Yes, a classic example of what I have in mind, the culprit's self-betrayal.
It was one morning early this year, I remember, when he came to see you by appointment. This is Mr. Wilson, Dr. Morell.
Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor.
Thank you, Miss Frail. Sit down, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you. It's very good of you to see me so quickly.
You have my assistant, Miss Frail, to thank.
It was her I spoke to yesterday on the phone and made the appointment.
A somewhat impressionable young woman, inclined to be influenced by an appeal to the emotions.
Well, I did make it sound rather urgent.
A matter of life and death was Miss Frail's description.
You see,
it was upon her insistence that it was a case of such urgency that I agreed to see you.
I'm very grateful to Miss Frail, and if I did sound so worked up, well, it could be a matter of life and death.
For whom, Mr. Wilson? For you?
No, Dr. Morell. It's my mother. I'm afraid that I'm going to murder her.
Try to relax, Mr. Wilson, and let me reassure you that it isn't altogether unusual for children to wish their parents dead, and sometimes to the extent that they become horrified, that they may transform the thought into action.
I'm not a child, Dr. Morell.
Quite. But there are few adults who are not inhibited by some hangover of childhood influences. I myself, for instance, have never been able to rid myself of the infantile compulsion to slide my finger along the banister when ascending or descending a staircase.
Oh, really?
Merely a manifestation by my subconscious of some childhood yearning, real or imaginary, for security.
Well, I'm sure my childhood was secure enough.
By the way, Mr. Wilson, I would prefer it if you didn't mention this little eccentricity of mine to Miss Frail.
No, of course I won't.
It might appeal to her as a matter for some levity.
I understand. Well, I had a happy home, a fine school and university. I'm doing well now. I'm an architect by profession.
And your age?
33.
Married?
No.
Is your father alive?
No, he died when I was a child.
And you live with your mother?
Yes, I designed our house, as a matter of fact, in Hampstead, overlooking the heath. Mother and I have always got along famously, and well, since I hadn't married, there was no reason for me to have a place of my own.
And you now find yourself suffering from an obsessive fear that you will kill your mother.
For the past 3 months, I've been having these ghastly nightmares.
They've always been the same sort of dream?
Yes, that I've got to kill her, murder her. Then last night, I had this dreadful dream again, and I woke up outside her bedroom. I'd walked in my sleep. I was holding a knife, a stiletto that I use as a paper knife. If I hadn't been awoken, I'm sure I should have gone in and stabbed her.
Murder your mother whilst walking in your sleep. An interesting possibility. Though I'm bound to say I've never encountered such a case in all my experience.
I shall do it. I know it. You must help me.
But you've always awakened from your dream in time.
Except last night I didn't. Someone else woke me. I was just going to enter Mother's room, holding the knife, and then Helen, Miss Keene, Mother's secretary companion, she heard me.
She woke you?
Yes, thank heaven she did. Otherwise I should...
Well, I'm quite sure that you would have woken up yourself, as you've done before.
But supposing I hadn't, Doctor, supposing I had stabbed her, I'd have been guilty of murder.
Well, as to that, no court of law would find you guilty of a crime when you were not responsible for your actions.
But, of course, I didn't come to you just to know that. Look, I'm terrified, I tell you, that I shall kill my own mother.
You would describe yourself as close to each other?
Oh, yes, that's why I simply can't understand these nightmares. And now, last night...
It's possible that you may have sleepwalked on previous occasions and returned to your own bedroom without you or anyone else being any the wiser.
I see. I hadn't thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Have you contemplated becoming married?
No. I am in love with someone.
And who is in love with you?
I think so. Yes. Yes, she is.
And have you asked her to marry you?
Not yet.
Do you wish to marry her?
Yes.
And she wants to marry you?
Yes.
Then...
Well, you see, that is my mother. Look, what's all this got to do with it? Helen understands.
Helen? Your mother's secretary companion?
Yes.
How long have you been in love with each other?
Well, I suppose it began a year ago, a few months after Helen came, although I didn't realize it at the time.
When did you realize it?
About 4 months ago. She told me she loved me, too.
And she understood that you couldn't have married her while your mother was alive.
Well, how did you...
You explained that she was a very understanding young woman.
Look, I came to consult you about these horrible dreams. What's Helen got to do with it?
Everything. You want to marry. You can't because you know it will upset your mother. In effect, your mother stands between you and your personal happiness. Subconsciously, you are aware of this, and though you try to repress this nagging truth, it confronts you in your dreams and nightmares in which you can remove the obstacle to your happiness.
Well, I can't believe it. It doesn't make sense.
On the contrary, Mr. Wilson, yours is the most typical case.
You mean to say that all I've told you has been brought about by Helen and I falling in love?
And because you can't marry for fear of your mother.
But surely you can help me. I mean, I thought you would.
Make out a prescription... Send you away with a bottle of pills? Well, it isn't as simple as that.
I don't think... Well, that is... Perhaps I'd better go. I'm very grateful to Dr. Morell, of course, but...
Ah, Miss Frail.
Yes, Doctor?
Mr. Wilson is just going.
Oh.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
At any rate, you've been able to satisfy yourself on one point.
What's that?
Well, if you should walk in your sleep and kill your mother, you won't be held guilty of murder. Not that, of course, that would happen. Anyway, not in your sleep.
Oh, dear, the morning hasn't started before that thing goes. Hello, this is Dr. Morell's house.
I must speak to him. I must...
Who is that, please?
It's Richard Wilson. I must speak to Dr. Morell. It's dreadfully urgent.
Oh, will you hold on, Mr. Wilson? Dr. Morell, it's Mr. Wilson on the phone. You remember he came to see you about a week ago.
Wilson? The sleepwalker with obsessive matricide tendencies?
Yes, Dr. Morell.
I'll speak to him. Mr. Wilson? Dr. Morell here.
Something frightful's happened. Please come at once, Doctor. My mother's dead. She's been murdered.
Lovely house.
A wonderful early morning view across Hampstead Heath. Remarkably fine.
You can see St. Paul's glinting in the sunlight.
And glimpse the figure of justice above the Old Bailey. Oh,
someone's coming.
Dr. Morell?
Yes?
Please come in.
Oh, this is Miss Frail.
I am Helen Keane, Mrs. Wilson's secretary companion. Mr. Wilson is upstairs in his room. I'm afraid you'll find him most dreadfully upset.
Oh, how awful for him. And for you, too.
Have the police been informed?
No. He wanted to see you first. If you'll come upstairs. This way.
Dr. Morell?
There he is. He heard you arrive.
Come up, please.
Go on, Dr. Morell and Miss Frail. I'll wait down here.
I telephoned you right away, Doctor. This is dreadful. The shock.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Wilson.
Miss Keane says that you haven't called the police.
I didn't know what to do. Then I thought perhaps I ought to let you know first. Mother's room's along here.
What about the servants?
The housekeeper doesn't come till 10. There's a daily help who turns up when she feels like it. This is Mother's room.
Oh, what a state it's in.
This is how it was when I found her. I haven't touched anything.
Stabbed through the heart. I'm afraid there's nothing can be done.
Oh, poor thing.
I should think death must have occurred several hours ago.
That's the stiletto I told you about.
So I observe. Are you all right, Miss Frail?
Yes, of course.
I came in as usual at 8:30 with her morning cup of tea, and there she was. Then I saw her dressing table had been ransacked and the window onto the balcony had been forced.
Well, her handbag's open, too.
Yeah, she always kept it there by her bedside. She had a note case, but that's gone.
The motive appears obvious enough.
She kept her jewelry in that case that's been thrown on the floor. The burglar must have disturbed her.
The bedclothes indicate a struggle. This stiletto, you had it in your possession that night?
Yes.
What did you do with it subsequently?
I was scared to keep it myself. I thought the best thing was to lock it away in Mother's bureau over there.
Well, it's been smashed open.
And the burglar found it.
Only Mother had the key.
Dr. Morell?
What is it, Miss Frail?
In her right hand, look.
I had already noted. It appears to be a portion of a man's necktie.
The murderer's?
She struggled with him, grabbed at his tie, and tore part of it.
Yes, a very ordinary tie of a pattern worn by thousands.
But still, it's something to go on.
Well, it's not unlike one of my own. Doctor, could I have done it? That's why I sent for you. Help me, you must help me. They'll hang me for it. Something I never meant to do.
Try to calm yourself.
But I must have come in walking in my sleep, broken open the bureau where I knew the dagger was.
But what about the jewelry?
I'd probably taken that and hidden it away somewhere.
Aren't you forgetting one thing? You were wearing pajamas. Or do you seriously suggest that you put on a necktie, a portion of which your mother is gripping in her hand?
Well, of course, Mr. Wilson, that's proof that you couldn't have done it. You just listen to Dr. Morell. He's always right.
Thank you, Miss Frail. Now, if you would listen to me...
Yes, Doctor.
Go downstairs and telephone the police.
Oh, but there's a phone here. Oh, of course, fingerprints.
You are improving, Miss Frail.
Oh, am I? Well, I'll go and phone Scotland Yard.
Dr. Morell?
Yes?
Will you tell them about my sleepwalking? I mean, despite what you say, I'm afraid they will suspect me.
Since you still seem so concerned, I think we may omit any reference to your somnambulism.
Oh, thank you.
I'll go in first.
It's all right, Miss Frail. I'll go.
Oh.
Wouldn't it seem better coming from me?
Perhaps it would be better for you to phone them.
I'll do that.
You got him to ring the police deliberately, didn't you? You've got that look on your face.
You are very discerning, Miss Frail. And what does that look signify?
Something you want to discuss with me confidentially.
Of course.
Do you think he's trying to pretend he did it in his sleep That's what it looks like to me.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but it doesn't look like that to me.
It doesn't.
You see, closer examination of the necktie indicates that Mrs. Wilson didn't tear it off in a struggle with an assailant.
Doesn't it?
Now, look for yourself.
Oh, I'll take your word for it.
Don't be so squeamish. Look. Notice how she grips it, the inside of the tie held against the palm of her hand.
Yes.
Doesn't that suggest anything to you?
No.
There are moments, Miss Frayle, when I could willingly... However, perhaps a simple demonstration will make my meaning clear. Sit down.
Yes, Doctor.
Now, I am leaning over you as if...
Oh, yes,
As
doctor.
If about to attack you.
Oh!
Now, grip my tie with your right hand.
Like this?
Your right hand.
Oh, yes, you've made me quite flustered.
Grip my tie.
Like this?
Well, do it as if you mean it, as if you know I'm about to murder you, which is a matter of fact.
Oh, what, Doctor?
Never mind.
Is this right?
You don't... you don't really have to strangle me.
Oh, sorry.
Now, do you see how you're holding my tie?
With the outside of it against the palm of my hand.
Precisely.
Oh, what is it, Dr. Moreau? What are you getting at?
Well, if my theory is correct, the logical conclusion is that the torn-off tie was planted to give a false impression.
Gracious. You mean that it wasn't a burglar who murdered her, but someone else? But you just said it wasn't Mr. Wilson. Well, who else then?
That remains to be seen.
What is it?
I thought I heard someone.
Wait.
Oh, Doctor.
Oh,
I was just making some coffee, and I was wondering whether you'd care for some.
Most kind.
Thank you. I'd love some.
Will you come down, then?
The police are on their way, Doctor. Hello, Helen.
Very good.
The police?
I just phoned them. Dr. Morell thought I should.
I'm sure he's right.
Of course.
And you still don't think I have to tell them about walking in my sleep?
But, Doctor, you...
Yes, Miss Frayle?
Oh, that'll be the police.
Oh, they've been very quick.
I'll answer it.
What were you going to say, Miss Frayle?
Oh, it was nothing.
I'm glad of that.
Richard, Dr. Morell, look at this.
Mother's note case, the one from her handbag.
That was the postman. He says he found it in the postbox when he was clearing it just now.
There's a pillarbox a few yards away from the house.
I recall passing it on our way here.
Look, let me look.
There's nothing in it.
He took all the money and pushed this into the pillarbox as he passed.
That would appear evident.
So it was a burglar, all right, just as we thought.
But, Doctor, you thought that...
Yes, Miss Frayle?
Oh, nothing.
Your mother's name and address was in it, so the postman brought it back right away.
Good. It may be useful to the police.
But what about fingerprints, Dr. Morell? Oh, but I expect they will be all blurred.
I expect you're right.
Here we are, Doctor. Have some coffee before the police really do arrive. Coffee, Miss Ray?
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that must be them this time.
I'll go.
No, you finish your coffee, Helen. It looks as if I've been seeing a lot of the police. I might as well start now.
What's the time? 6 o'clock. Where is Miss Frayle? I must dictate these notes. This could prove of inestimable value.
Dr. Morell?
Ah, Miss Frayle.
It's Scotland Yard. Inspector Hood is waiting in the study.
Eager, no doubt, to reveal that with which I am already
familiar. I didn't realize that you would...
Come, we mustn't keep our human bloodhound waiting.
Thought I'd just drop in, Dr. Morell, on my way back to the yard.
I'm very glad you did, Inspector. And now... As I'm sure you've noticed, Miss Frayle is all agog to learn the object of your visit.
I think I've got some news for you. But first of all, I do want to thank you for your help this morning. That tip-off about the tie, for instance. Well, I don't mind admitting, I might not have spotted that.
Well, I'm sure you would, Inspector. In any case, it was by no means conclusive, as I advised you at the time.
Quite so.
It merely seemed to indicate that Mrs. Wilson hadn't torn it from an assailant, as it appeared... But it had been planted to give that impression.
I demonstrated with Dr. Morell that she would most certainly have gripped the tie differently.
Have you arrived at the truth?
Have you made an arrest?
Hardly, Miss Frayle.
Oh, but surely, I mean, if you knew who committed the crime as well as Dr. Morell...
Dr. Morell? I didn't realize you'd come to a doctor.
But naturally, he realized who it was right from the start.
Well, I'll be...
Well, didn't you, Doctor?
As usual, Miss Frayle has given rein to her imagination, Inspector... I hadn't reached any conclusion this morning. Otherwise, I should, of course, have acquainted you accordingly.
I'm sure you would have.
Do say who it is.
All right, Miss Frayle, I'll get down to cases. If the doctor doesn't mind listening to what he already knows...
The truth can never be too often repeated.
Well, it was the tie, really. Once we realized it was a plant, all we had to do was to know who had planted it. Then we'd be home and dry.
Oh, who did plant it?
Now, just coming to that...
You must try to curb your impatience, Miss Frayle.
We scouted round the house and the garden. There were footprints and evidence of a ladder having been placed against the garden wall on the inside to look as if the burglar had got into the garden that way. It was all very cunning. The only mistake was they didn't go far enough. There were no signs of the ladder against the outside wall.
Oh, goodness.
Goodness had nothing to do with this, Miss Frayle. Of course, it was an inside job. That disorder in the bedroom, all very realistically done.
But the note case in the pillowbox.
Ah, that was a master touch.
I was wondering when you were coming to that.
Yes, just the sort of thing a burglar would do. Grab the money, get rid of the note case in a pillowbox he was passing.
Then who was it who thought up all this?
I talked with young Wilson, but he didn't give much away, understandably. He seemed knocked over by the shock. It was the secretary companion, Miss Keene, who proved most helpful.
Who's in love with Mr. Wilson.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Never mentioned it to me, either of them.
Did you ask them?
I didn't, as a matter of fact. Hardly seem to be the types to fall in love with each other. He's obviously wrapped up in his mother, and she's the practical, capable type. Absolute opposites.
Ah, Inspector, that's where you're not such a good detective.
Eh?
Not when it comes to investigating the human heart. It's just those types who are completely different who fall in love.
You think so?
Mm-hmm. The nervous young man and the girl, all poised and self-assured. The tall woman and the short man, and vice versa. The vague, silly little feather brain and the suave, sardonic man of the world. Don't you agree, Dr. Morell?
I can only say that I stand amazed at this revelation of your powers of perception.
Yes, I was afraid that was all you would say.
Anyway, whether they were in love or not, it's got no bearing on the case.
No, Inspector?
Not as it's turned out. Miss Keene was very frank. And as a result of what she said, the motive was obvious.
Proceed, Inspector.
Oh, this is absolutely enthralling.
Well, as you know, Mrs. Wilson had been left plenty by her husband when he died. The money was invested in South America. I won't go into the details. She was devoted to her son, and he to her. Given him all he wanted. Education, travel, training to be an architect, all the trimmings. Then, suddenly, a few weeks ago, it happened. All her money went up the spout. She awoke one morning to find herself comparatively flat broke.
Oh, poor woman.
She didn't tell her son. It was he she was most concerned about. He'd only just got going as an architect, and without her financial backing, he was finished before he'd begun. So she decided there was only one thing left for her to do. Alive, she wasn't worth a penny. But she carried life policies to the tune of £20,000.
You mean...
That's it, Miss Frayle. She was worth more to her son, dead.
Oh, how dreadful. Isn't it, Dr. Morell?
Hey, Doctor?
Quite dreadful.
Of course, he would collect the lot. But, and this was vital, her policies carried a suicide clause. If Mrs. Wilson committed suicide... They wouldn't pay up a cent.
A not unusual stipulation in a life insurance?
Quite. Oh,
so she deliberately took her own life, but make it look as though she'd been murdered.
That way her son would collect.
I can't help admiring her.
Inspector, you communicated your conclusions to the son?
Yes, I broke it to him gently. He didn't take it too well.
And Miss Keene, she was also informed?
She seemed more prepared for it, but then she knew of Mrs. Wilson's financial state.
Oh, that poor, desperate woman plotting and scheming like that to kill herself, and all for nothing.
I should be moved to feel as you do, if what the inspector just described to us happened to be true.
What?
Dr. Morell.
What do you mean, Doctor?
I mean that Mrs. Wilson did not commit suicide. She was murdered.
Dr. Morell.
The house looks very dark.
There's a light in the front room.
Where Mrs. Wilson used to like to sit.
Come on. You wait here, driver.
Yes, sir.
There'll be a wireless car along any minute. Information room will have told them the drill.
Yes, sir.
Just tell them we've gone in, and I want them to wait outside the front door and keep their eyes peeled.
Very good, sir.
Let's hope the gate isn't locked.
It's all right.
Come on. Now, where's the bell push? It's so dark. Ah.
It's quite chilly.
Would you rather go back and wait in the car?
Oh, no.
Now, I'm going to leave this for you to handle, Dr. Morell.
I'll endeavor to be a credit to you.
To think that if it hadn't been for you, I still can't get over it, the dead cunning of it.
Inspector Hood, what brings you back again? Oh, hello, Dr. Morell. Miss Rail.
Good evening.
Sorry to disturb you like this.
I should have thought you'd seen enough of this house for one day.
Not quite, Mr. Wilson, I'm afraid.
Well, come on in.
Thank you.
What is there about all this to interest you, Dr. Morell? Inspector Hood has told you, of course.
I have heard his version of the matter.
Well, let's go into the front room. Helen's just gone upstairs. So the inspector's version doesn't add up with yours. Is that why you're here?
Oh, I thought we might have a quiet talk, Mr. Wilson.
What have you found out? Something more about poor mother?
When you realized her motive for taking her own life, what was your reaction?
Well, frankly, I couldn't believe it. I still find it difficult to accept the idea. We've been discussing it, Helen and I. It just doesn't seem like mother. Helen's told me how she made her swear not to tell me about losing her money. I'm afraid she realized that she was very wrong not to have told me in spite of her promise. Why, it would have made it easier for us to marry. Mother might have been less difficult about it.
No, I didn't know that you and Miss Keene were...
Oh, well, I didn't mean to mention it, and you didn't ask me.
You didn't ask me either, Inspector.
Helen.
Miss Keene.
Good evening, Dr. Morell. Miss Frail.
Good evening.
Good evening, Miss Keene.
I heard people arriving, so I came down. I didn't guess it was you.
I've been telling Dr. Morell what you and I have been discussing.
You mean my promise to your mother?
I was just saying how it might have made it easier for you and I to get married.
Yes, I heard you. But Dr. Morell, surely you and Inspector Hood, not to mention Miss Frail, aren't here merely to inquire what Richard's reactions were when he knew that his mother committed suicide for his sake.
Not altogether, Miss Keene.
It would hardly require the three of you just for that, plus the support of another police car which has just arrived.
Oh.
Helen.
I noticed it on my way downstairs.
You don't miss much, Miss Keene.
Well, what is all this? Have you got police outside?
It concerns the note case in the pillar box. Hmm? You will recall, Mr. Wilson, that the postman returned it just after 10 o'clock this morning, after he'd cleared the box. For your information, the first collection is at 8:30 a.m.
Well, what of it?
The supposed burglar, who at first was presumed to have murdered your mother, apparently then threw the note case in the pillar box after leaving the house in the early hours.
But we know now that there wasn't a burglar. Mother tried to make it look like that.
There wasn't any burglar. Perfectly correct. But, Mr. Wilson, nor could it have been your mother who slipped the note case in the pillar box.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, if she had, it must have been found at the time of the first collection at 8:30 a.m.
Why, yes.
She couldn't have placed it there after that, since by then she'd been dead for several hours.
But of course, that must be right.
Dead right, Mr. Wilson.
Well, then who did put it there?
The person whose fingerprints have been found on the note case.
But...
And who was also listening outside your mother's room just before 10 o'clock this morning and overheard me inform Miss Frail that the torn-off necktie was a plant, and who then hurried out to the pillar box in a last desperate effort to divert suspicion. The same person, Mr. Wilson, who, learning of your mother's financial crash, saw no future in marrying you unless you inherited the £20,000 insurance.
Helen!
You won't get me!
Helen! Helen, come back!
It's all right. You won't get very far. You can see from the window.
Helen! Helen! It was her all the time.
Now, they've caught her. She's putting up a struggle, but they've got her all right.
Oh, it's too horrible.
I was watching her face, Dr. Morell, while you were talking. She went absolutely white. I thought she was going to faint.
It's usually Miss Frail who is so overcome.
Miss Frail! Miss Frail! She's passed out.
I thought the excitement might prove too much for her.
The way you solved the sleepwalker case was out of this world.
You are too kind, Miss Frail. I have encountered few criminals who went to such elaborate pains to cover up their tracks. Disposing of the note case in the pillar box, for instance... For all her ingenuity, she found herself driven by a subconscious compulsion to overplay her hand and so encompass her self-destruction.
But surely she betrayed herself by her fingerprints on the note case. I call that just plain stupid.
My dear Miss Frail, did I never explain that to you?
How do you mean?
Well, naturally, her fingerprints were on the note case. She put them there when she took it from the postman. So they proved absolutely nothing at all.
But what?
Bluff, my dear Miss Frail.
Bluff?
Just bluff, yes. It had been a long day, remember. I wanted to force a confession out of her without wasting any time, so that I could get back and proceed with my work in the laboratory, which was much more important in my estimation.
But, Dr. Morell...
That reminds me, Miss Frail, if I may continue with dictating these notes.
Yes, Doctor. Where were we?
Well, I was observing that every criminal is motivated by an inner compulsion to bring about his self-destruction. In order to achieve this act of self-betrayal, the evildoer cannot resist from drawing attention to his own crime.
was another adventure in a BBC series featuring Ernest Dudley's famous character, Dr. Morell, and, of course, his secretary, Miss Frayle. The artists taking part were Dr. Morell, Cecil Parker, Miss Frayle, Sheila Sim, Helen Keane, Moira Lister, Richard Wilson, Hugh Burton, Inspector Hood, Philip Ray. This recorded program was produced by Leslie Bridgemarth. You're listening next Saturday afternoon for another case for Dr. Morell, this time the blackmailer.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio and an episode of the BBC drama, A Case for Dr. Morell, starring Cecil Parker and Sheila Sim. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. In a moment, a movie preview of the 1936 musical One in a Million, starring Sonny Henny and Don Ameche. But first, from 1956, here's Frank Sinatra with his version of Cole Porter's I've Got You Under My Skin, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
You under my skin, I've got you deep in the heart of me, so deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything come what might for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Why not use your mentality? Step up, wake up to reality. But each time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop just before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. Yes, I've got you under my skin.
Mr. Wall, this is some block we live in.
How's that, Bertie?
Well, practically every woman in this block is a good cook. Now, take Miss Simpson. No woman can broil steaks better than her. And Miss Salson, her specialty is hot breads. Casserole dishes like baked shrimp is what Miss McKendry does there. That's the way it is up and down the whole block. Every one of them's a good cook. And every one of them uses parquet margarine as a spread and for cooking, too.
Well, that's not surprising, Bertie. Parquet's so nutritious and after
Mr. Wall said the reason our block is a parquet block is because parquet margarine tastes so good.
It's economical, too. Costs only about half as much as the most expensive spread.
That's right. But economy is as economy does, I say. And what that parquet margarine does is taste so good.
Why, sure, parquet is made from the selected products of American farms. So I think that more and more women in every town in America are going to use parquet margarine. They like it because it's nutritious, because it's economical.
But mostly, Mr. Wall, because it tastes so good.
Right you are, Bertie. That's the plain truth about parquet, the delicious margarine made by Kraft. And remember, in many states, you can now buy parquet margarine in yellow quarter-pound sticks.
Twentieth Century Fox presents a radio preview of One in a Million. Show in a Million, One in a Million, featuring the sensational screen debut of Sonia Henie, Olympic queen of the silvery skates, whose flashing grace and dazzling beauty has thrilled countless thousands. For her first screen appearance, 20th Century Fox has surrounded her with this great, all-star, all-entertaining cast. Adolph Manjou, Jean Herschel, Ned Sparks, Don Ameche, the Ritz Brothers, Arlene Judge, Bora Minovich and his gang, Dixie Dunbar, Leah Ray, Shirley Dean, and hundreds of singing, dancing, skating beauties. And now our show gets underway with one of radio's fairest favorites, Leah Ray, singing One in a Million.
One in a million is lucky in love. One in a million is blessed from above. While others thought romance, I left it to fate. I never took a chance, the odds were too great. I've a conviction that I must be wrong. Stranger than fiction, you happened along. So it's a million to one, it is true. My one in a million is you.
The thrilling story of One in a Million starts with the adventures of a troupe of American entertainers who arrive at a famous European winter resort to start an engagement at a large hotel, only to find that the place is burned to the ground the night before.
As the scene opens, the luckless group have repaired to a small Swiss inn, where their manager is trying out his worst German on the proprietor. The roles are portrayed by Adolph Monju, Jean Herschel, Sonia Henny, and Arlene Judd.
Haben Sie Rumen?
Oh, you wish room.
You speak English.
Oh, yes, my father also.
Why didn't they say so in the first place?
You would take the long way around.
I'm sure we can accommodate
you. Oh, yes, welcome to my little hotel. Will you please sign? I hope he can be of service to you.
I hope so, my good man. I certainly hope so. We arrived this evening to keep an engagement at the Grand Palace Hotel and found the place in ruins. An accidental conflagration, I suppose.
Oh, there are all sorts of rumors going around. Some say it may not have been quite accidental. We have plenty of rooms here now. At the moment, we have only one other guest.
Splendid, splendid. My wife and I shall require a very large double chamber. The girls can double or triple as the case may be. You have baths, I hope?
Oh, yes.
And food, I hope.
Well, it looks as though they have found at least a temporary refuge. And leave it to Adolph Manju to figure out a new scheme. In the meantime, let's listen to the toe-tingling music of Bora Minovich and his famous harmonica rascals, who play, and we really mean play, an important part in the picture. Amici, handsome star of screen and radio, plays a newspaper correspondent in One in a Million. And one of his not-too-hard-to-take duties is to write about the new ice skating queen, Greta Muller, played by Sonia Henny. Let's go away in their sleigh as Dan Cupid takes them for a moonlight ride.
You know, in America, the boy generally puts his arm around the girl when they go sleigh riding.
They do that in Christian, too.
What are you thinking about?
Me?
Good or bad?
Well, I'm not quite sure.
Why not?
The first time I met you, I thought you were very nice. But the second time, not so good. Tonight you did something for me, which makes me think that you are, well, like the first time. So I'm a little confused.
You know, my mother once said, Robert, always trust your first impression. It's the best.
I wonder if she was right.
You'll agree, it looks as though they're getting somewhere. And now, make way for those merry, mad masters of mirth, merriment, and mimicry. You howl at them in Sing, Baby, Sing, and you'll roar at them in One in a Million. The Ritz Brothers.
Come on!
Forget about her. She won't show up.
Of love and a pleasant surprise. Don Ameche discloses a grand singing voice in his version of the tune.
Who's afraid of love? It's something we sing about. I haven't the slightest doubt that life without it is cold. Afraid of love. What else are we living for? How can anyone ignore the sweetest story that's told? Those who found love know nothing more sweet to hear than this how love I love you. You love me, so who's afraid of love? It's stuff of which dreams are made, and dreams can't make me afraid. Who's afraid of love?
Who's afraid of love? Something we sing about. I haven't the slightest doubt that life without it is cold. Who's afraid of love? What else are we living for? How can anyone ignore the sweetest story that's told? Know nothing more sweet to hear than the sound of I love you, you love me. So who's afraid of love? It's stuff of which dreams are made, and dreams can make me afraid.
The fast-moving plot of One in a Million reaches a thrilling climax as Adolphe Manjou unwittingly jeopardizes Sonia's Olympic chances by placing her in his show. Here's the scene as played by Adolphe Manjou, Don Ameche, and Sonia Henning.
Honey, you are marvelous. I never saw the lie in my life. You slayed them all over the ring. One little suggestion. In your next number, give them some more of those pirouettes. I'm sure they'll... Well, Harris, how do you believe me?
Get in your street clothes. We're going home.
Hey, what is this? What's coming off here?
Greta skates.
But she's got two more routines to do.
She's not doing them. You've done her enough damage already, Spencer.
Damage? Me? What kind of talk is that?
The fact that she appeared with a professional troupe like yours makes a professional out of her. And also probably makes her ineligible for the Olympic Games.
So she's ineligible. So who cares?
No, no. It would break my father's heart. You said it was just an exhibition.
Break his heart if you make $1 million?
What business is this of yours?
Oh, I'm more or less the innocent spectator. You know, the guy who always gets carried out in a stretcher. But I've got some information which you may not have. Mueller has been building Greta up for 12 years to win the Olympic Games. It's very important to him, for reasons that we don't have to go into right now.
Oh, what's more important? A silver-plated cup or a gold-lined future? Why, she's going to become the greatest sensation the amusement world has ever seen.
Why?
Wait a minute. I found her, and I'm going to keep her.
There's no doubt that there's trouble ahead for someone, because Sonia's out to win the world's Olympic skating title. And when you see her in One in a Million, you will thrill to the greatest exhibition of skill and daring the screen has ever known. Because, as the whole world knows, she's the world's greatest. And now the entire cast joins in a rousing melody. We're back in circulation again.
We're back in circulation again. This is our lucky day. The coop is hanging high, not a cloud is in the sky. Everything is okay.
We're back in circulation again. Right back where we belong.
Why, we haven't any dough, but we're happy as we go, rolling merrily along.
Like a dog, climb a sleigh ride with jingle bells. Someday we may ride with wedding bells.
We're sitting on top of the world. We'll ride high again.
Our hearts are all aglow, and we want the world to know. We're back in circulation again.
It's the show of a million thrills, one in a million. 20th Century Fox's mightiest musical triumph, with Darryl F. Zanuck in charge of production and featuring the dazzling debut of a radiant, glamorous, brilliant new star, Sonia Henie, in One in a Million.
The golden age of radio on WMKY and a movie preview of the 1936 musical One in a Million, starring Sonia Henie and Donna Meche. This has been the golden age of radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows, on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the golden age of radio next week at this same time and channel on WMKY 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.